Long, long before Obamacare, way back in the day, doctors usually did more harm than good. They didn't know how to recognize disease, and their array of remedies were more like magic potions than medicine. To understand what healthcare was like in early America, we'll speak with Elaine Breslau, a retired professor of history at Morgan State University. Elaine Breslau provides a fascinating and skin-crawling chronicle of the 18th century, the practitioners and their practices, from purging to bloodletting, and the whole realm of alternatives to the infection-fighting medicine that was being developed in Europe. Lotions, potions, pills, and magic, Elaine Breslau on healthcare in early America, after the news. And welcome back to Midday, everyone. Dan Rodericks here. This is our second hour. Thanks for sticking around. While we Americans have a lot to complain about, including all the shortcomings of our expensive healthcare system, we get a dose of perspective this hour from Elaine Breslau. You will certainly conclude by the end of this hour that in one significant respect, life in the 21st century isn't so bad. Elaine Breslau has brought her scholarship to bear on healthcare in early America. And if just that phrase, healthcare in early America, conjures unsettling images of sick colonists being bled on purpose and folk healers being called to the bedsides of the deathly ill, there's good reason. That's what it was like back then, in the age before medical science advanced in its understanding of infection and doctors found ways to do more good than harm. Before that time, Elaine Breslau tracks how Americans survived, and in many cases did not survive, the medical practices of the early 17th century through the 18th century. Her book, Lotions, Potions, Pills, and Magic, describes the evolution of childbirth practices and the conflict that developed between midwifery and doctors with obstetrical implements, the brutal treatment of the mentally ill and colonial-era slaves, how the doctors of the day were unable to treat or prevent the major epidemics of smallpox, yellow fever, and cholera, and how many of them refused to recognize the advances being made by medical science in Europe. We open a door this hour into healthcare in early America thanks to our guest, Elaine Breslau, retired as professor of history from Morgan State University after 29 years and has taught on an adjunct basis at Johns Hopkins University, Goucher College, and the University of Tennessee, Knoxville. She has written four books now, and the titles of two of her previous are certainly intriguing: Tituba, Reluctant Witch of Salem, Devilish Indians and Puritan Fantasies, that was 1995, and Witches of the Atlantic World, an historical reader and primary sourcebook from 2000. Both of those were published by NYU Press, as is her latest, Lotions, Potions, Pills, and Magic, Healthcare in Early America. Elaine Breslau, welcome to Midday on WYPR.
Thank you, Dan. I'm glad to be here.
You know, one thinks of the colonies. I'll go there. The colonies, the frontier, people living off the land, people living out in the woods somewhere or in clearings, and then villages developing and towns developing. And in that distant time, you know, 200 to 300 years ago now, when did that person known as the doctor emerge? Who was that person, say, 250 years ago, 225 years ago? Who was the doctor?
Well, the doctor came with the early colonists. In fact, the pilgrims brought a doctor with them on the ship. And most doctors had gone to college and then gone on to medical training, which came after college. And so whenever there was someone from Europe who had been trained either in England or Scotland or on the continent, they called themselves doctors and they came to the colonies. But there were no graduate programs here in the colonies until Johns Hopkins University at the end of the 19th century.
Wow.
And so people depended upon other doctors to teach them, mostly as apprentices.
Did people go to the doctor or did they avoid the doctor?
Well, they avoided the doctor if they could. Doctors were expensive to start with, and so it took money or produce, whatever you could do to pay the doctor if you used his services. So it was a lot cheaper to go to a local herbalist or someone who knew something about, thought he knew something about curing or thought she knew something about curing. Doctors also, in the 18th century, they were not as extreme in their methods, but it still was too expensive to do. And in many cases, if they lived in a small village away from an urban area, they did not have access to doctors.
You have to give us the sort of the lay of the land for these first people who came into our country here in terms of their health, how long they lived, and what kind of health problems they faced, say, in the early 17th century.
Oh, that's very interesting, because if you're up in New England and some of the communities there, you might live into your 70s. Hmm. This was absolutely extraordinary. They had a very low infant death rate and a very long life expectancy, which declined over time. So the first generation born in one of the towns might live to the 70s, the next generation to the 60s, and it continued to decline. Probably the closer to the 40s, which is what it remained in the 18th and 19th centuries in this part of the world.
And why was that, Elaine? Because of disease?
Oh, the absence of disease. Many of these communities were fairly isolated. They did not have direct contact with ships coming in. And so they experienced what the American Indians had experienced, isolation from most contagious diseases from Europe. Plus, and this is also very, very important, they had adequate food. We don't have any reference to famines in America, whereas famines occur so regularly in Europe and in Britain.
Excuse me. My question was, why the declining longevity? Why the
I'm sorry.
Why did it decline? Why did people once live in their 60s and then it turned they were dying in their 40s? Was it because of smallpox and other diseases?
Because they were no longer as isolated.
Ah.
And therefore they had more contact with more diseases.
When someone got sick then, we'll go back to the doctors here. When someone got sick, okay, what could the doctor do for someone who, say, had a fever or an infection of some kind?
Well, they gave them all kinds of medications. The first thing the doctor would do would be to bleed you. That was considered to be the usual therapy for any kind of disease. Then he might give you something to cause you to vomit, and then he might give you something else to evacuate. The belief was that disease was some imbalance in the body, and therefore you wanted to readjust the humors of the body. And you did that by depleting the body of some substance.
Did our listeners just heard you say readjust the humors?
Yes, that's what they call.
Yeah, we need some help with that. Please, so a little bit of understanding about humors in the body and what all that theory was.
Okay, well, there were four humors. There was blood, and there was the black and yellow bile, and like that presidential candidate, the fourth one is escaping my mind.
That's okay. But this goes back to ancient Greece, right?
Yes, yes. These are beliefs that go back more than 2,000 years, actually. One of the reasons why it was so hard for doctors to accept new ideas is that this had been the assumed problem of the body for so long that it was just simply convention and inconceivable that disease could be caused by anything else.
Well, this idea of readjusting the humors in the body, that's where bleeding and purging comes in?
Yes.
So this idea of bleeding, I mean, did doctors use leeches, for instance? We've heard a lot about that.
Yes, they did use leeches, but first they preferred using a scalpel or some little, they had a little device that just cut the skin. And they would take the blood from the vein and let it drip into something, often to the point where the patient would simply pass out.
You know, I don't want to spend too much time on this, but you do spend a fair amount of time in the book on it, because it seems like the treatment for almost everything involved bleeding or purging in some way, sweating another one, right?
Yes, yes. And, of course, the leeches that you mentioned, they did use leeches. But anything that would remove a substance from the body was considered to be good medical care.
Is the fourth humor phlegm, Elaine?
Phlegm, yes.
Phlegm. So now we got it. So it's, what did you say? Blood,
black bile, yellow bile, and phlegm.
Okay. Now, you referred to medicine a moment ago. The doctor would give you medicine, but it's not medicine the way we think of medicine today. What they regarded as medicine in the 1700s. Can you give us scope that out for us, please?
Oh, there'd be various concoctions. There was a pharmacopoeia, which listed all the possible medications, the combinations of various ingredients, some herbal, some chemical, some mineral. And the doctors, in some cases, they did have things that would reduce phlegm. They had things that would reduce some pain. They could always give you opium. But it was they would be various concoctions. There was no science used to prove that anything worked. And if something worked for a particular patient, the doctor would usually assume that it would work for everyone. Mm-hmm. And so they would use the same thing over and over again, even if it didn't work on everyone.
Okay. Now, this is important for us to understand, because I'll be going back and forth between the colonies and Europe to ask this question. What was the parallel in medical practice in the early 1700s in Europe? What was going on there versus in the colonies? Well, was it the same?
It was the same. It was the same. It isn't until the 19th century that the Americans begin to diverge from the European methods. So you've got the same. And the books that were written that doctors use and that people used when they didn't have a doctor mm-hmm. were the same books that were used in England.
And it's certain that they had no understanding of infectious diseases yet, the spread of diseases such as smallpox. They didn't know what they were dealing with, or did they?
No, but yeah. They didn't know what they were dealing with, but they had some sense of that if they isolated people, then they could stop the spread of the disease. So they knew that some things were communicated from person to person. They didn't know how. They didn't know why. And so you have isolation hospitals, pest hospitals, lazarettos, called all three. When a ship came into port, for instance, in almost all European cities and in most colonial cities, the ship would be quarantined. And if anyone was sick on the ship, they would be put into a pest house and isolated until they were mm-hmm. back on their feet.
Mm-hmm. So there were some decisions about these things that went on beyond the doctor. In other words, the community was involved. There was some understanding or appreciation of the idea of public health.
Yes, at least from the point of view of what was coming into for the country from the outside. Mm-hmm. There was no idea of public health or clean water, for instance, or providing clean water for a community. But they knew that if there was a disease and it was possible to isolate those who were sick, then they might protect the environment. But it doesn't go much beyond that.
Elaine Breslau is our guest. Elaine, we're going to take a little break here. We'll come back and pick up our conversation in just a moment. Just a short break here on WYPR, The Midday Show. Elaine Breslau is joining us this hour. Her book is Lotions, Potions, Pills, and Magic, Healthcare in Early America. If you have a question for our guest about what I just said, healthcare in early America, in the colonial period up through the revolution and even after that, please give us a ring, 410-662-8780. Your opportunity to ask a question of our guest. Our toll-free number is 866-661-9309. The Midday email address is midday@wypr.org. Long, long before Obamacare, way back in the day, we're talking about healthcare in early America in this hour of midday with Elaine Breslau, retired professor of history at Morgan State University, now a visiting lecturer at the University of Tennessee. Her book is Lotions, Potions, Pills, and Magic, Elaine Breslau on Healthcare in Early America. So, Elaine, I said, and you've said in your book, doctors for a long time did more harm than good. People seem to understand that if they went to the doctor, he was going to cut them someplace and make them bleed for a while or give them something to make them purge or something, right? And that would be the extent of the treatment that they would receive. And yet, so people went nonetheless, right? knowing that they could die if they went to the doctor.
Well, they didn't expect to die.
Sorry, I'm trying to get a sense of that. Everyone has trepidation, I guess, about going to a doctor or a dentist, right? But in the day, knowing that you were going to be there was a chance that you would be the doctor would bleed you. People went nonetheless. I guess they had no choice.
Well, they didn't think the bleeding would kill them because they were so used to it. They expected it. I mean, you take the case of George Washington, who had an infection in his throat, and before he could have the doctor, before the doctor arrived, he had his overseer bleed him because that was the usual therapy for almost any kind of discomfort. So people expected to be bled and thought that it was helping him. And what you missed was the special ingredient of the doctor's therapy, what I call the magic, the power of suggestion, the confidence in the doctor. People believed that the doctor would make them well.
Okay. And so that so it's sort of probably a placebo, would you say, placebo effect? You go to the doctor and he pulls a little blood out of your arm and you feel better.
Definitely. And then when he gives you some foul-tasting pill to take or some lotion, potion of some kind, it causes you to do something, lose something else from the body, you feel that he has done something for you, and so you feel confident that you're going to get well.
Now, when did all this? When did all that go away? When did doctors say, listen, I think it's not a good idea to bleed people anymore? How did that happen?
Well, that happened in this country a little later than it did in Europe, but let's say sometime in the 20th century. Some doctors had stopped some of this extreme depletion technique in the middle of the 19th century, but most doctors continued. Most patients expected it, and when the doctor did not bleed them, they asked why. I mean, it's like going to the doctor today with a cold and asking for an antibiotic, and when the doctor says, no, that's not going to help you, you still want it. And so in the 19th century and well into the beginning of the 20th century, people still expected to be bled. And so doctors did what they wanted.
Elaine, I just need to ask you this. In the early as late as the early 20th century, would doctors accommodate this wish?
Oh, sure.
So they would just pull some blood out of someone's finger or something? What would they do?
Oh, the arm, usually the arm, somewhere in the inner arm.
Because people expected it.
Because people expected it, yes. Yes.
That's amazing. I don't know. I had another question for you, but I'm going to go to the phone lines and start introducing our listeners into this conversation with Elaine Breslaw. Oh, by the way, on the Dan Roderick's Facebook page, I posted a photograph I found of an 18th century medicine kit, 18th century medicine box. It's a beautiful thing with beautiful containers. And one of them is tincture of rhubarb.
Oh, yes.
Yes. That was very popular, wasn't it?
Tincture. Oh, yes. That would have a very dramatic effect.
What did tincture of rhubarb do for the patient?
Well, you know what diarrhea is like.
Ah, okay. So you would evacuate.
You would evacuate.
Right. Very good. We're going to take a call from Lolita in Baltimore for our guest, Elaine Breslaw. Hello, Lolita.
Hi. My question is, can you talk about the period in time where homeopathic and medicine was used in America as well as Europe, and that period of time where allopathic and homeopathic had a divide? And I'll take my answer off
the air.
Sure.
All right. Thank you, Lolita.
Yes, that's easy. Well, that's 19th century.
Mm-hmm.
Those were competing medical theories, competing against the orthodox doctor, and really gave doctors a lot of competition. And many of them began to lose their patients at that point because the choice was between taking this homeopathic, highly diluted medication, which probably had very little effect on the body, compared with the bleeding and the purging and the vomiting and the extreme methods used by the doctors. and many people just had begun to shift away from this method. But there were many, many other types of herbal concoctions that were being promoted in the 19th century.
Elaine, there were slaves in the colonies, of course, during that period of time into the 19th century. Could you talk about how they were treated, if they were treated at all by doctors?
Oh, they were definitely treated by doctors. The plantation owners depended upon the doctors to come in and treat their patients. The slaves, unlike white people, did not have any choice in the kind of medication they would have to take. And from the point of view of the slave, the doctor was supporting the slave system, and he was a surrogate master. There was a real tension between the slave community and the doctors. Plus the fact that slaves, Africans, preferred their own type of medication, the kind of folk medication and spiritual healing that had been more characteristic of Africa.
You note in your book that they were forced to go to doctors despite these strong feelings about the traditions that they had come been brought to the country with.
Yes, yes. They had no choice. They had no choice. And the result was the identification of white medicine with enslavement.
Another question for our guest, Elaine Breslau. This one from Shirley in Pikesville. Shirley, welcome to Midday. Hi.
Hi. I always enjoy your show, Dan.
Thank you.
I have a question. I've studied a little bit of pharmacology, and I know that American Indians used the leaf of the digitalis plant for what they called dropsy, which is now we know was probably congestive heart failure. But I'd like to know, are there any other herbal medications that the American Indians use that have now been proven to really have a therapeutic value?
Thank you, Shirley.
Well, that's a question I can't answer. When it comes to modern medicine, I'm pretty lost. That's not my field. Mm-hmm. Most of the medication used by the Indians, or some of the medications used by the Indians, were also adopted by the colonists. For instance, Ipecac, which was a very strong purgative, was used. The digitalis, by the way, was also used by the Europeans. That wasn't characteristic of the Indians. And you're right, it was used for what was called dropsy, which was really heart failure.
I didn't realize how old digitalis was until I noted it in your book.
Yes, yeah. Yes. It's not, it was used, it's an ancient medication.
We should talk about the natives a little bit more, though. Their relationships to your story that you tell in your book, Lotions, Potions, Pills, and Magic. We go back, Elaine, to the early, into the 17th century for this. So please talk about that a little bit, the natives and what became of them in terms of the colonists and their health care.
Oh, this is, there's been a lot of research that has been done on the Indians to figure out why they were so susceptible to the European diseases, in particular smallpox, measles, various types of respiratory diseases. And they died in such large numbers. The assumption is that they'd had no contact with communicable diseases. But there's some other additional research that seems to indicate that over the centuries that the Indians had lived in the New World, they'd actually lost a lot of the immunities that Europeans continued to have. And so genetically, they were unable to develop immunities to the diseases that then hit them in the contact with the Europeans. By the same token, at the time of the first contact, almost all the Europeans noted how big the Indians were and how healthy they were and how clear their skin was, since most Europeans had pockmarks from the smallpox that they'd had as children, and the Indians did not have those marks. Their skin appeared to be so much smoother and clearer than the Europeans. But that turned out to be certainly a problem in terms of the diseases that they then had to fight. And it took a long time for those immunities to develop.
Elaine, I want to talk about folk medicine a little bit. So how do you describe or define folk medicine as practiced, say, in the 17th and then the 18th century? And then the relationship of the practitioners of what you would call folk medicine with doctors?
For the most part, their theories were very, very similar, and they used very similar medications. probably less mineral and more herbal medications. But they too believed in bleeding. But probably the major difference between the two is that almost all folk medicine has some kind of spiritual or ritualistic magic practice that it goes with it, taking the medication after you've walked around a circle three times, taking medication at a full moon. There had to be some other quality besides the medication itself, something that doctors rejected. They had become very, very secular in their choice of medications and the way of using it.
But did people view doctors as having almost magical powers then?
Well, I do.
Yeah.
I'm sure they would not have put it in those terms. But it really has the same. The doctor's manner, the doctor's bedside manner, the doctor's education, the doctor's stature in the community, all of that worked to gain the confidence of the patients. And by the way, even today, apparently, if you have confidence in your doctor, the medication will be much more effective.
Say that again, Elaine?
Well, according to some researchers, if you have confidence in your doctor, the medication will be much more effective.
That's very interesting.
The magic has not been lost.
This totally makes sense. Elaine Breslau is our guest. New York University Press is the publisher of her book, Lotions, Potions, Pills, and Magic, Healthcare in Early America. If you have a question for Elaine, please join us here at 410-662-8780. Our toll-free number for midday is 866-661-9309. I guess we established it with my question that, you know, earlier about people avoiding the doctor because, well, if you couldn't afford to go to the doctor, you obviously, they didn't have insurance in those days. But what existed in terms of preventative medicine? Did doctors, were doctors figures in their community who would speak out about issues of public health to warn people about how they needed to take care of themselves, to tell mothers how to raise their children and how to, was there anything like that? Or did you just seek the doctor when you felt bad?
No, there were doctors, especially those with the higher education, who were concerned about public health. And Benjamin Rush is one of them, though I'm highly critical of Benjamin Rush and his therapies in my book. The one area in which he was really very, very important is in the area of public health. During the yellow fever epidemic in Philadelphia in 1793, he advocated cleaning the streets, getting rid of the pools of water, which would have helped because the problem with yellow fever is caused by mosquitoes who are breeding in these pools of water. There was rotting food at the dock, so that cleaning things up. He thought in terms of what they call the miasma, that is a smell arising from rotting food. Mm-hmm. And if you clean that up, then you would reduce the amount of disease. And it was very important if they would do that kind of thing. So there were many doctors who looked for some kind of a public health program. This is apart from their role as physicians to individuals. This is their public persona. And they had a very important public persona.
Hmm. Interesting. You've written about witches in the past in your other work, and it gets me to the question of mental illness and how the mentally ill were treated during this time. It's sort of probably the most brutal part of the book to read about how people were treated, what treatments were given to folks considered to be mentally ill. But would you please talk about that?
Yes, the incidents I found, which was of Mary Stuart, who apparently deviated from her family and her religious views and was assumed to be insane. And by the way, evangelical religion for many of these people was considered to be a sign of insanity. And so this poor girl was put into Benjamin Rush's tranquilizing chair, which was to reduce all outside stimuli and force her to be completely controlled in her physical movements. This was a later development. This is something you'd find toward the end of the 18th century, and that continued in the 19th century, because before that, most people who were considered to be insane or eccentric in some way, it was assumed to be something that was very temporary, and so people would either be confined to a room or just simply left to their own devices. And they would. They would come back to join the seine, and then they would have another episode. And for the most part, it was ignored until the 18th century. And then doctors saw this as a physical problem, not just a mental, but a physical problem, and tried to control it while using physical means. And that's what poor Mary Stuart was suffering from at the end of the 18th century.
Some doctors employed beatings.
Yes. Yes. That's another 18th century idea that somehow or other the person had lost his reason and was like a beast. And so you treated the individual as though he or she was a non-thinking individual, which required beatings.
There is an illustration in your book of Dr. Rush's tranquilizing chair that you were just describing that was designed to restrict all the physical movements. So you were strapped in, your feet,
yes,
your hands, across your torso, strapped into the chair, and even a bucket to catch bodily wastes.
Yes.
Yeah.
And the head was restrained so that one could not see anything except what was directly in front of you, to reduce all kind of visual stimuli.
And there came a time, I don't know when this started, the institutionalization of the mentally ill then. That goes back a ways as well, does it?
Yeah, the first one was in the late 18th century in Williamsburg, Virginia. But it was just simply for custodial care, because these people were wandering around the streets, and the community had grown large enough that it was disturbing to other people. And so the asylum was used simply as a place to house the insane. But by the 19th century, you begin to get more and more doctors interested in using some kind of physical treatment of the insane. And one of the worst, because I tried it myself, was a cold shower for 15 minutes. I lasted about a minute, I think,
right.
This cold shower.
Even given that, how violent that actually sounds, it brings me to this question for you as a historian researching all this. It's hard for us to stand here in the 21st century and look back and without being appalled, being aghast, and cringing at some of these remedies, these ideas that doctors had. These were people who had been trained, right? They had attended school. They were better educated than those they were treating.
Yes.
Is it possible to step aside and say, I appreciate that at the time there was all this ignorance around them. They just didn't know. This was not a science yet. This hadn't advanced.
Yes, you're right. I mean, they were doing what they had been trained to do, and very few people questioned the techniques or the theories behind what they were doing. And if there's nobody questioning, then there's no reason for questioning yourself. And this doesn't happen until the cholera outbreak in the 1830s, 40s, and 50s, when the traditional depletion techniques were pretty obviously killing people.
Mm-hmm.
And those who were left without these techniques, who had no medical assistance at all, had a better chance of surviving than those who were in the hands of a doctor. That's where the homeopaths and the hydropaths come in, because they were advocating very minimal kinds of treatments, treatments that kept the patients comfortable and hydrated. And they were much more successful during these outbreaks than the doctors were. And it finally forced some moderation of many of these treatments. The doctors didn't admit that they were doing it, but they certainly moderated their treatments after that.
Elaine Breslau is our guest in this hour of midday. We'll take a short break here and come back. More of our conversation with her about healthcare in early America. Her book is Lotions, Potions, Pills, and Magic. When we get back, all about childbirth and this conflict that developed between midwives and doctors a long time ago in the early part of this early America. Healthcare in early America. If you have a question for Elaine Breslau, this is a good time to call 410-662-8780. We welcome your questions. And welcome back. Elaine Breslaw, our guest, her book is Lotions, Potions, Pills, and Magic, Healthcare in Early America, published by NYU Press. A question from Tom by email for you, Elaine. Could the bleeding process possibly have triggered some type of response by the body to stimulate healing in some patients? It's an interesting question. I would wonder, as time went by, other medical historians looked at this and said, yeah, there might have been something to that.
Well, apparently it reduces the amount of iron in the blood, and that may have a good therapeutic effect. It's also, I think many doctors did it because it caused the patient to be calmer. I mean, if you're losing the blood, you're quieter, you're easier to talk to, easier to handle, and so it might act as a sedative. It definitely acted as a sedative.
Yeah, right. And you think you're getting treatment. You think, well, this is what happens to everybody when they go to the doctor. This is what they do for you. So already I'm feeling better, right?
That's right. You know, people go today for all kinds of chemotherapy, and they're absolutely miserable. But they're pretty sure that this is going to help them and that they're going to be better at the end. And so I assume the feeling was the same when it came to bleeding and purging, that this is awful. And you have to suffer through it, but at the end you're going to be well.
On my Facebook page, I posted a cartoon that I found online of Man Midwife, it's called. It's from 1793. It's the Man Midwife cartoon. It's also published in Elaine's book. This cartoon comments on the male versus female methods of handling deliveries, the scary obstetrical tools in an unadorned clinical kind of room on one side. Actually, it looks like a blacksmith shop. And
<Yes. laughs>
I'm sorry. And in contrast to the warmer setting of the midwife, but I describe this cartoon because it's really a perfect point for our discussion to talk about this conflict that developed when doctors figured out they needed to be delivering babies, that actually they could make money from doing this.
Yes. By the 19th century, there were so many doctors, so many poorly educated doctors. If you can imagine, there were 400 medical schools in the United States in the middle of the 19th century, most of them run by doctors as proprietary schools for the purpose of making money. And so you had a lot of competition for doctors in the 19th century. And what they wanted to do was to find a new outlet for their so-called skills. And midwifery seemed to be the place to go. Midwives really had a monopoly of most of the childbirth, through the centuries and right through the 19th and right into the 20th century. Most women preferred to have a woman help them deliver their child. But doctors wanted to get into the field, and they had one advantage. In the 18th century, the forceps had been invented, which could help in difficult births. Before that, in difficult births, what happened was the fetus was killed in order to save the life of the mother. And for the first time, it was possible to save both the life of the mother and of the infant. And midwives did not use those tools. And so doctors had an advantage when they were trained in the use of these other methods. And so they began to advertise that they provided safer, less painful childbirth in an attempt to move in on the midwives. Well, that didn't work. I mean, they certainly acquired some upper-class women, but most women continued to prefer the midwife. And so they decided that one way of pushing the midwife out was to organize in some way and then make sure that the midwives could not handle one particular area, and that was abortions. The number of abortions was increasing in the 19th century as more and more women were attempting to control their family size. And they turned to the midwives, and they had all kinds of herbal methods of doing this and some other mechanical methods. What the doctors tried to do was to ban the midwives from all kinds of abortion as a way of pushing them out of the profession. It didn't work. Whenever they tried to get a law on the books, the law could not be enforced. So they really failed in that area. Now, this is before the Civil War.
Okay. Did they fail? But they didn't. Okay, so they didn't eliminate midwives.
No.
But did they reduce the number of midwives? In other words, did doctors control this market, so to speak, of baby deliveries?
No, they did not. Okay. And what few investigations we have, and I did not do any investigation on my own. I drew on many other sources. Mm-hmm. Shows that the women continue to use midwives. There's one study of Petersburg, Virginia, that indicated that midwives continued to be very, very important in the town, right through the 19th century.
Well, women had been doing this for centuries, right?
That's right.
And so the question would be, well, did the doctors change anything in terms of infant mortality? Did the doctors getting involved in baby deliveries lead to more babies surviving and women surviving childbirth?
Well, we don't know, because doctors caused another problem, and that is the childbirth fever. Since they did not believe it necessary to wash their hands, and they would go from one sick person to another and then go deliver a baby, and very often the woman would then suffer from the fever and might not survive the childbirth. So it's balanced. They may have been able to protect some babies and mothers with the use of forceps. At the same time, the lack of clean hands may have killed other women. We have no way of knowing. There are no records that we can draw on. There's no statistics. There just isn't enough information to indicate that one system was safer than the other, except for the fact that most women continue to go to midwives.
What was the parallel in Europe at this time, Elaine?
Oh, well, midwives there were receiving medical training, and there was never any question of the doctors pushing the midwives out. So the midwives continued to be highly trained, and that was the accepted method of childbirth. Doctors were called in only when instruments were necessary.
Another question for Elaine, this one from Joel in Essex. Thank you for calling Midday, Joel.
Hi, thank you for entertaining my question. I'm very curious about when anesthesiology came into being, such that a person could be put under while an operation was ongoing. I know they had the morphine, I believe, in the Civil War, but I was wondering if you could enlighten us on that subject.
Yeah, there were three available. There was ether, there was nitrous oxide, and there was chloroform. And chloroform was developed by an American in the 19th century. But surgeons refused to use any anesthetic. Dentists used them. And one medical historian, a little bit of a wit, said that, well, the dentists expected their patients to come back. Surgeons seldom had a repeat patient. But surgeons prided themselves on their strength and dexterity. Qualities that really weren't as necessary if the patient was anesthetized. And they refused to use the anesthetics. Well, there was also another reason. If the patient went unconscious, it was usually because of shock. And so for most surgeons, to have a patient actually unconscious was a threat to the patient's life. And so they just did not want to use the anesthetics that were available. And the same thing applied during childbirth. The male midwife did not use it either. Many of them believe that women should suffer anyway, so that there's no need to use a painkiller for them.
Elaine, just for a moment, I'd like to go back to this parallel with Europe again. And when we get to an understanding of infection and how to fight infection, for instance, this type of medicine was being developed in Europe. I gather from your book, it was virtually ignored here for a time by the doctors in America.
Oh, it was ignored until probably late 19th century, early 20th century. We don't really know. You know, we have this incident of President Garfield and this recent book on
a terrific
his life.
Book, yes, on yeah. his death on yeah. his, and how he died, yeah.
Mm. Right. I read that book after I finished mine, and I insisted I had to put in a sentence about him. But here's 1883, and doctors are using their dirty hands to probe his wound. And the floor is dirty, and no attempt was made to at cleanliness. And when one doctor was faced with somebody who suggested that there might have been germs, he poo-pooed the idea. I mean, this was invisible. You couldn't see anything like that, and therefore it couldn't be a factor. But here, 1883, the doctors actually killed the president of the United States unwittingly. So obviously, the idea of germs and the idea of cleanliness was not as well accepted until much
later.
Well,
why? Why did this take so long? And I asked that question, and then I want to read the quote from the front of your book, which I think might help you with the answer. You have a de Tocqueville quote here, actually,
oh, yes,
from 1835, you say, "In few of the civilized nations of our time have the higher sciences made less progress than in the United States. Democratic institutions generally give men a lofty notion of their country." And that's de Tocqueville in 1835.
Yes, and he could have been talking about the medical profession, but he was not at the time. But I thought it was so apt because most American doctors just simply refused to accept the scientific developments that were occurring in Europe, whether it was the germ theory, whether it was the idea of antiseptics. They didn't think it was necessary. And as the rubber glove was being used in surgery in Europe, Americans rejected the idea of the rubber glove. They would not accept what were becoming not quite standard, but the more advanced methods in Europe at the time, in the second half of the 19th century.
What's the answer to that? Why? Is it arrogance?
Part of it. Americans, you know, for so long, Americans had been so much healthier than Europeans because they had all this food, because generally speaking, they were bigger. They seemed to be more immune to diseases than Europeans because they were healthier. And so this idea that Americans were exceptional in some way, and of course they felt that their government was superior to Europe, which it probably was, I mean, a more democratic system. And then by analogy figured if their government was superior, obviously their systems were superior, and they did not need these systems that were being used in Europe where the Europeans were more inferior. I mean, some of the arguments they used in the 19th century are just, oh, frustrating for the modern historian. Didn't they see how wrong they were? But this was the idea, that Americans were exceptional, and we don't have to follow the European lead.
You know, we started this conversation talking about life expectancy, and you noted that in some parts of early America, in the North in particular, people did live into their 60s or 70s. But that fell over the decades, that fell, and that now, of course, it's back up, way up again, to more than, 78 years old in present-day the United States.
Yes.
And the only reason, because I've noted this from your book, and every time I see a movie depicting colonial period, and you see some old person, you know, trying to listen to a conversation, they're hard of hearing or something, and I wonder, did they really have old people then?
did people really live
that long in George Washington's time? No.
Yes, they did. I mean, certainly Benjamin Franklin lived into his 90s.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
Thomas Jefferson and John Adams both lived into a ripe old age.
They drank wine, that's why. Yeah.
Probably. They didn't drink water, they drank wine.
Yeah.
But yes, no, there were people, there always are people who genetically or for whatever reason will live longer than others. We even see that today. Some people suffer from all kinds of diseases and some people do not. So that even in the colonial era, this was one problem. Yes. By the way, may I mention just one other book that I've written that you did not mention?
But go right ahead.
The biography of the doctor who came from Scotland to Maryland in the 18th century, arrived in Annapolis in 1737, and was a man by the name of Dr. Alexander Hamilton, and he's not related to the famous Alexander Hamilton, because that's a very common name. But he had received some of the most advanced training in medicine in Scotland before he came to the colonies.
All right, Elaine, we're short of time. I'm glad you mentioned that title. I wish we had more time for that. I left that one off because I was intrigued by your other titles on witches. But I have to remind folks now, because we're at the end of our hour, of your latest book, Lotions, Potions, Pills, and Magic, Healthcare in Early America, published by NYU. And what's the title of the Hamilton book, quickly?
Dr. Alexander Hamilton and Provincial America.
Okay. Elaine Breslau, this has been a treat. Thank you so much for your time.
Oh, you're welcome, Dan. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, everyone. That's our midday for today. We'll see you again soon.